this afternoon. It's an opportunity to for me to reflect on Buddhism, the way of inner peace, as the title on the poster says. And also, this is my first time in this part of the world, and I'm certainly enjoying it, and the beauty of the countryside and the hospitality that I've received in Toronto and in Tisarana. Rajan Virdemo and I trained together from many years ago in Thailand, and so we've known each other for as monks for many, many years. So when he said he was going to establish the Tisarana Monastery here in Ontario, I was very pleased, and of course wanted to offer any support, any help I could give, because it is a task, you know, to start monasteries is not necessarily an easy thing to do. And I know from experience, having done quite a bit of that kind of thing myself. Now, in the past 50 years, there's a noticeable growing interest in Buddhism in the Western world. And this, of course, my interest began in the 1950s when I was in the Navy. And I was on a ship that was a supply ship from San Francisco to Japan. And there I was introduced to Zen Buddhism in Japan. And at that time, in the 1950s, there was a cultural exchange taking place between the U.S. and Japan, and one of the good results of that was people began to take an interest in Zen Buddhism. The Japanese type of Buddhism, as it was translated into the English language. In those days, it was very difficult to find any kind of Buddhist literature in English. So what was available was greatly appreciated, greatly kept safely in one's flat or one's home. And nowadays, of course, there's a plethora of Buddhist literature. You can go to bookshops in London or whatever. You have option paralysis. There's so many choices to make because of this growing interest in the teaching of the Buddha, but especially what is most interesting to the Western world is meditation. And of course, meditation is a word that covers almost any form of mental exercise. They use it quite freely for anything that you do with your mind. But in terms of the Buddhist meditation, then this is it has a certain style to it, of looking inward and observing. It's the essential word, the kind of key word, and the very essence of Buddhism is the word mindfulness. And this is a human ability to observe oneself, that we're not just helpless victims of the conditioning we've received or our physical bodies or our emotional habits, that we can observe. And this ability to observe, to reflect, to recognize our own mental states, our own physical feelings, reactions to the world that we live in, is the whole essence of Buddhism. Because the word Buddha itself is an ancient word from the Pali Sanskrit tradition of India, in which it means the awakened consciousness. So sometimes Buddhism is considered a religion based on the Buddha, which is in many ways true. He was the Gautama, the Buddha, was the founder, and were the result. The Buddhist monks, nuns sitting here at this time, is the result of the Buddha's efforts to look into himself, observe, and then be able to put into a teaching a tradition, a form, a way of speaking that was handed down from one generation to the next. So that was 2,553 years ago in India. It's never really taken root in the West, even though it spread from India into all of Asia. At one time, most of in the Asian continent was Buddhist. Afghanistan, Pakistan, they were all Buddhist at one time. And even in, there's records of Buddhist monks being seen in Persia, in Iran, and even in Egypt, and I hear even in Germany. But it didn't take root in the West. And I know from my own experience, it was seen just from the American cultural attitude as just some Asian religion. But what people find interesting and compelling about the Buddha's teaching is it's about awakening, waking up to life, to be the observer. Many of us were unable to just feel a religious spirit, to just be caught in believing what we're told. It especially appeals to the skeptical nature of the human individual, because it is a way of investigating and finding and recognizing the truth of the way it is. And we call this, in this Pali word, the Dhamma, or reality itself. So one way of defining or Buddhism is awakening to the real. Now, in my own experience, this leads towards inner peace. And I remember when I was in the university in the early 60s, there were many peace movements there in Berkeley. I was in Berkeley, California, which was one of the kind of strongholds of protest and peace movements of that time. So there was much interest in peace. And so I became interested and involved in these various movements. But in the process, I began to realize that even though I was demanding peace or requesting peace, or complaining about the lack of peace, that actually I wasn't peaceful myself. My mind was not peaceful, it was not in a peaceful state. And so I liked the idea, the idea of peace was great, I could really wish life was more peaceful, but having to live with myself 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 24/7, this was increasingly more difficult because of the conflicts, internal conflicts within me that I couldn't really blame on external events. So this led me to take an interest in meditation. At that time, I had been interested in Buddhism from the 50s when I was in the military, and then developing that interest through reading books, but not really practicing. There were no teachers that I could find at that time of meditation, either in Zen or any other Buddhist tradition in the San Francisco, Berkeley, Bay Area. So I felt one thing I needed was to practice what the Buddha taught, not just acquire more knowledge and more concepts and more ideas about it, but to actually do it, which led me into the Peace Corps in 1963. I was in the training program when President Kennedy was assassinated. And that took me to Southeast Asia, to Sabah, North Borneo, and which had, by the time I arrived, had become part of Malaysia, East Malaysia. So it was through this experience in the Peace Corps that I became aware of the Theravada form of Buddhism. And this is the type of Buddhism you would find in Sri Lanka, in Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, in Burma. And of course, in parts of India, there's still remnants of it. And this particular tradition is considered kind of from the original. It was, the Pali language was a vehicle for carrying the teachings through time, through generations, to the present. And of course, the essential original teachings, as we were told and believe, are from this tradition. So, when I finished my Peace Corps contract, I had the opportunity to. I took the advantage of the situation, went to Thailand, which is a Buddhist country. It's about 95% Theravadan Buddhists, Of course, I went there. I couldn't speak the language, but I did have addresses of various monasteries, various temples to go to. So I started in 1966. And my intention was only to be a monk for 2 years, but now this is my 44th year. So it has been a kind of an opportunity and a wonderful opportunity for me to use this life as a way of investigating my consciousness, the world that I create, the fears, the desires, the greed, the delusions that tend to be part of my character as I develop. And this way of looking then is what we call mindfulness. It's our ability as human individuals to observe, to be aware in a way that isn't judgmental or critical or complicated, but a simple state of discernment, ability to know what feeling is like this, or to recognize the conditioning that we've acquired in one's life. And this will, of course, when we investigate this further, we begin to see how we create suffering in our lives, how we, out of ignorance, out of not understanding, out of merely operating from habits, from the force of habit, and through the ego or the personality or through the cultural conditioning that we've received, how we create conflict within our minds. And so this was the conflict that I became aware of before I went to Thailand, when I was in California protesting in front of the Atomic Energy Commission in Berkeley, demanding peace. And of course, peace is, how many of you really know what peace is? You know, this is the ultimate question. Well, in the when there's war and there's conflict and that, then we want peace. But peace also, in itself, is rather boring. You know, it's not because our emotional life is conditioned for extremities. We want happiness and romance and adventure, excitement. And of course, wars are exciting, and all the kind of things that excite the human mind. Made a Hollywood film about peaceful Buddhist monks. Probably nobody bothered to go to it. But you know, you can make an exciting movie, maybe about Buddhist monks that do wicked things. Because that is exciting, and we like to We are conditioned for that, for extremity, for happiness and for the heights of the positive, of excitement, of romance, adventures, traveling, change, and interesting hobbies and pastimes. And then, of course, life isn't, doesn't present us with the occasion where life can be just a peak experience of happiness and romance. But as you all know, that life has its pleasures and its sorrows. And so this is the pleasurable side. We certainly want that. And the sorrowful side, we don't. So when we, because of this ignorance, then we don't understand ourselves or the world we live in. And we tend to blame others for our suffering or see ourselves as something inadequate or something wrong with me, that I should be a happy, contented person, but I'm not. Now, when I went to live in Thailand, it was the northeastern part of Thailand. This is in 1967, when I went to stay with a teacher, Ajahn Chah. And he was living in we lived in forest monasteries. I started meditating in Bangkok, which was a good beginning, but Bangkok is a very exciting city, and the monasteries there were very busy, and so I didn't want to train in Bangkok. So I deliberately chose to live in more remote parts of that country, which led me to northeast Thailand, to the province of Ubon Ratchathani, and to the forest of Wat Pa Nongpa Phong, which is Lungpa Cha's, Ajahn Chah's monastery. And there, of course, people sometimes ask, why would we be establishing a monastery in this part of the world, out in the countryside, near Perth? I don't think it has a predominantly Buddhist population here. And why would we choose such a remote area? And of course, it is this sense of the forest tradition of living close to nature. So this is, when I went to live with Lungpa Cha, we didn't have a common language at first, because I didn't know his and he didn't know mine. But one thing that I immediately sensed with him was that he worked in a kind of intuitive way. He didn't need the common language so much as he understood the nature of human beings, whether they were Thais or foreigners. So I felt, even in spite of the lack of comprehension on the linguistic side, I felt at least I seemed to be understood as a human being there. And then over the years training at this monastery, I began to learn the language well enough to understand what he was actually saying verbally. But the point of the teaching is to turn inward, to look, to be the observer of the state of mind, just the experience of consciousness within the limitations of one's physical body, and the reality of the continuous, unrelenting sensory impingement that we, all human beings, have to bear with throughout their lives. And so Ajahn Chah is very good at kind of pointing to just the way it is, not particularly in any personal way, but for just being a human individual living on this planet, of just observing, this continuous, relentless impingement or irritation onto the senses, onto the body, onto the mind that we are so used to, that is a part of what we just take for granted, that we don't know anything else. And yet, in many ways, we want peace from this continuous, changing, irritating, sensitive realm that we're living in. And so peace, then, what do we mean by peace? And this, of course, is the search for, say, inner peace, because externally, peace is not a permanent quality that is available through the senses or through the thinking and emotional states of mind that we have. But in the ultimate reality, as we begin to see the futility and the result of constantly trying to get something, trying to change something, trying to control, trying to manipulate, trying to deny or suppress our feelings or our emotions, this constant resistance or constant ambition to get something, the way we feel frustrated by our own limitation, physical limitation, mental, emotional limits. And then the inevitable aging process that we all have to experience of growing up, being born, growing up, and then getting old, and then the death, physical death, which none of us have experienced yet. But in our lives, we've all had to experience death of our loved ones, or people, friends, pets, or whatever, loss through death of those around us. So this is a common human experience, that this realm is about birth and death, about change, about contact with changing conditions, about our own bodies, which are, you know, seemingly very vulnerable, delicate forms in a very vast and mysterious universe that we can observe in a way. We get a perspective on it. But also, we recognize our own vulnerability, a sense of our own delicacy, and how easily we are hurt physically or emotionally through these changing conditions that we have very little control over and very little ability to make them what we would like them to be. So then in the Buddha's teaching, he pointed to his own mind, began to observe that peace was something that he, you know, was his true nature. Once he let go, once he stopped this restless search for happiness or for refined states of consciousness or for pleasure or trying to control his mind and his body to being the observer and the knower of the way things are. And so this kind of teaching, of course, allows us to begin to recognize the way it is, which is the body is like this. Like, for example, the getting old is like this. Now I'm an old man, so I notice I have experience with age and the problems that come from it. Then in terms of loss, seeing, you know, at my age I've seen my parents, teachers, friends pass away. And of course one observes this, the way it affects the grief that one feels in the loss of the love, or the endless frustrations that one feels through the community that one's living in, or the society, or the country that one is living with. And we see that no matter what governments, you know, try to provide us with, that there's nothing external that can really give us inner peace. That's something we have to find for ourselves. And this peacefulness then is the aim and the goal, to recognize it It is not a sense of annihilation of the conditioned realm, but it's letting go of that blind attachment to the arising and ceasing, the birth and death of the physical world, the emotional, the mental, the psychic world that we're experiencing. Once we have this insight into non-attachment, then that is what we call peace or nirvana. So this is, of course, this is, the Buddha said, you know, that this is available. You don't have to be a kind of superman or especially sublime, highly attained individual. He made it very clear, this is about being a human being, like we are, ordinary human beings. And of course, his teaching is based on the most common experience that all human beings share, whether they're at the top of the ladder or at the bottom, whether they're male or female, rich or poor, is the experience of suffering. So when he, history of Theravada Buddhism, the Buddha, when he gave, after his enlightenment, he gave his first talk, his first reflection. It's called the Teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth that he gave was, there is this suffering, or this unsatisfactoriness. It's a statement of fact that no matter what our position is in the society, you know, being the richest or the poorest, being young or old, healthy or sickly, privileged or not, we all experience this sense of unsatisfactoriness, of discontentment, of loss, of grief, of sorrow, despair. We all have to deal with the restlessness and the changingness and the inability to control life that is part of any human experience. And so this first noble truth, the Buddha's taking the most banal and common human experience that all of us can recognize. It's not esoteric, it's not refined, not sublime. It's what we all don't want, isn't it? None of us want to suffer. And so we would like to be happy. And so much of our life in the modern world is about seeking happiness and comfort and security in the external world around us. So then the Buddha proclaimed suffering as a noble truth. And so this is quite significant, because it isn't a metaphysical truth. It's not ultimate truth. So it's just stating that there is this experience, that we begin to change our attitude towards it from just trying to escape or blaming it on others to understanding it. We begin to recognize, yes, suffering is, there is this sense of incompleteness, of discontentment, of unhappiness, or anxiety, or worry that haunts the human consciousness. And so this is the reason why it's noble, is that we're changing from just the human individual running away from suffering to understanding it, to looking, to recognizing it. And it is a truth. It's this reality that suffering is like this. And it's not about blaming it on anybody or anything or on God, or it's just recognizing the state of being incarcerated in a human form and the changing conditions, the emotional sensitivity that we feel, the way we can suffer from just people's insulting us or spreading rumors about us, or suffering about the way the society is or what the neighbors think. We can endlessly create forms of suffering in our lives. And of course, this is, this we all can relate to. This is common, ordinary kind of suffering. The second noble truth is about the causes of suffering. So suffering is an ultimate reality. It's not a kind of pessimistic, kind of unpleasant recognition. Life is suffering and you just have to put up with it. It's about understanding suffering and then also recognizing how we create suffering through our ignorance, our lack of understanding, our heedlessness, selfishness that tends to motivate us and drive us throughout our lives. So this is, of course, what meditation means to me, is a change of direction from controlling or seeking or asking favors from above, to have special privileges or special miracles apply to me and my life and my family too, beginning to look at myself, look at this sense of incompleteness, unhappiness, or fear, worry that I definitely was very good at creating in my life. Now this realm that we're living in, this planetary life that we're now experiencing at this very moment, is a fear realm. I mean, there's so much to be afraid of. It's not just some kind of personal neurosis, but it's the survival ability, isn't it? There's so much to fear from environmental change, from climate change, from all kinds of unknown possibilities of meteorites crashing into the earth, or the sun going out, or the moon falling on the planet, or who knows what. We, in our imagination, we could imagine the most terrifying scenarios that are very frightening to us. And if we don't tend to maybe create such dramatic scenarios, we do have this sense of anxiety and worry. What's going to happen when I get old? What, the changing of the economy, the loss of loved ones, the changing of society in ways that we, may not want it to change. The enemies, external enemies, the terrorists or whatever, these forces outside that threaten to destroy our security or take what we depend on for this sense of happiness or security. So in our reflection, we're observing that this realm is, its very nature is insecure. There's no guarantee that any of us will live tomorrow. It's more than likely, but in terms of death, it could happen at any moment. We also recognize, as a physical being, how delicate our forms are. Easily bruised, easily damaged. We don't have the tough hides of an elephant or a rhinoceros. We can't run as fast as an antelope. We can't swing from trees like apes. We're pretty hopeless. As a creature, anyway. But we have clever minds, so we've developed weaponry and ways of protecting ourselves that help to give us a sense of security. We have armies and we have policemen and so forth that we have agreements on behavior, not to, murdering another human being is illegal or is a crime or stealing. So we can have a sense of security in this limited way, and we have moral agreements on how we relate to each other. So even though in moments we might have strong impulses to kill each other, we don't. because we have agreed not to do that. Or maybe we're afraid we'll be punished for it. But in terms of the Buddhist sense of morality, it's about seeing that taking on these precepts, these moral precepts, in order to make a commitment to our way the way we relate to other human beings and to our own families and our society, which is based on morality. To not, with intention, kill another human, or to steal or take things that belong to others, or to be irresponsible about our own sexual natures, to just take advantage, misuse, or abuse other people out of our own heedlessness and selfishness. It's about being responsible for speech, about being one who's not using our speech to lie or to cheat or deceive or insult or intentionally harm anyone else. And then also we encourage restraint in terms of intoxicants and drugs, not to get involved in addictive substances. So these are the kind of five precepts, moral precepts, that the Buddha encouraged for all of us. But, and of course, as we take on the monastic training, that is even more more commitments to restraint. But for the lay people, we encourage these five precepts, which is our ability as human individuals to take responsibility for our lives, how we're going to live in this world, in this society, in terms of our physical behavior and our speech. So our intention is to live in this society in a way that is honest, truthful, not in any way to cause disturbance or division with intention. So for those of you who wonder about the intentions of Tisarana Monastery, the intention is to be a good member of society, to be one that is considerate and responsible for how we live, how we relate to the local society and to the country itself. This is one of the great gifts of being human, is that we can agree. We can't always help how we feel. We can still have murderous impulses or wanting to lie or steal something. These are part of any human experience. But we have the determining factor of being responsible not to act on impulses of this nature, to let that be our passive side, not to intentionally harm or deceive the society and the others that we live with. So then this leads towards a sense of self-respect, because we find that we are living in a way that most of us would respect if we saw it in other people. And when we see people responsible for their behavior and living their lives in this thoughtful, considerate way, then we can feel a sense of respect for those individuals, as well as ourselves, when we put forth and make that endeavor and make that commitment. So this is learning to live in the world, in the society, learning to be part of the society, not to just shut ourselves, shut the doors and not want to know anything or engage with the society we're in, but to live in the society in a way that is both depending on it, bringing out its good qualities, and also being able to serve the society in ways that we do through our own experience, through our own knowledge that we have, through our own meditation practice. So I can say in my life, I've lived the first 10 years in Thailand and the last 33 years in England. And of course, it's been, you know, in Thailand I actually had the training and developed the insight. But then living in a European country, in a non-Buddhist country, has been quite a profound experience also, because it has been, I feel very grateful, very sense of a sense of gratitude to the British society because of its tolerance and also the way that I can live as a Buddhist monk and also contribute to the welfare in my own way that I'm quite capable of doing, the welfare of the society that I'm in. So I will, anyway, this sense of inner peace, again I reiterate that this is something that we can recognize within ourselves as we develop this mindfulness. We begin to recognize our true nature. And we're no longer what we think or what we believe or just these changing forms, these aging forms, and these restless conditions that we're experiencing through our bodies and through our senses. But we begin to have this sense of a oneness, a wholeness, a completeness through the practice and development of mindfulness. So now, I think I've spoken long enough. I can go on and on. But I will now stop at this point and open up the possibilities for questions.
Test, test. Thank you, Ajahn Sumedho. I have a portable mic here, and I can go to those who wish to ask questions and hand them the mic so everyone can hear. Perhaps we can have the house lights on a little bit. Yes. Are there any questions?
Hi. How do you calm your mind enough to reach a level of mindfulness or peacefulness? It's probably a big question, but when everything is so busy or you're feeling that you don't have the life that you want to have or to lead, how do you calm your mind and be still enough to be the observer?
It's like, first of all, the direction of observing is like when you say if you are upset or emotionally stressed at any moment, you're aware of it. You know, you feel, you say, I'm really stressed out or upset. And that is because, you know, there's that knowing of it, or you're feeling it in your consciousness. And so at that point, you know, when you're just trying to get rid of it through trying to control it, we tend to create more tension, you know, as you keep stirring it up by resisting and fighting it. So this is where one needs to really just see to when one is feeling stressed and upset by something, to just, I find ways of just reminding myself to let go, to relax, to observe, not feel I have to do anything, or that there's something wrong with this feeling, but just observing, say physically, what the kind of physical reactions you have to your emotional state. This will, and through this sense of informing yourself, just to let go and relax, will is a very skillful way of calming down enough to be able to go deeper or to experience a sense of calm later on when you've been patient enough to let the stressful conditions cease. Because the you know, what I find in the Western world is that we tend to, we're what you call control freaks. We want to control the mind. And so we when we have an unpleasant mental state, we want to get rid of it. So we either distract or take some kind of drug or drink or do something to distract ourselves from the causes of the stress, which create even more problems. So with meditation, this is learning to just trust yourself more, to be the observer of it's like this. And by just being patient with emotional stress, you'll feel a sense of it being of fading out.
We have another question here.
Yes, thank you. So from your intuitive sense of things, do you think when the Buddha became enlightened that he was, so to speak, finished with suffering?
Well, in let's say he was finished creating suffering. But even in the scriptures, in these Pali scriptures, the suttas, he had to live the rest of his life, which was the experience of, getting old, of illness, and then there are a lot of, he had to endure all kinds of blame and criticism and threats from the society. So these are, so that it doesn't mean you get out of, you kind of sneak out of the whole mess and live in a realm of bliss, but it means that one stops creating suffering around the experiences of life. So you begin to recognize the difference between the suffering I create out of ignorance and just the natural movement and change and what we say karma of our human state. So, like they have this law of karma, cause and effect. And so the Buddha, when he was being blamed or persecuted by others, he didn't create suffering around it. He recognized that this is just his karma, what he is enduring. And through that, he didn't compound the unpleasantness of the existing conditions with ignorance and suffering that he would create himself if he didn't know this. So it's like it's a when you get to the, I think it has a perfect paradigm really of relationship of this awareness with the conditioned realm. Like the aim of the Buddha is to his enlightenment was recognizing deathlessness, or that which we cannot define, we cannot observe as an object, but that which is our true nature. And so that is not seen in personal terms or in defined terms or in any language, but through mindfulness. We have this awakened, conscious insight into ultimate reality. And then from there, our perspective on the conditions that we experience at any moment are seen in perspective, like seeing it as, no longer from just blind reactivity and habit, or seeing it in terms of what it actually is and its nature of arising, ceasing, and change.
Any other questions? I'll bring the mic over there.
Ajahn, thank you so much for being with us today. I have two questions. The first one is that observing that you are talking about, is it part of Khanti endurance? And the second question, probably not related to what you're talking about today. Like in the Western world, when we are stressed out, we always get suggestion or go exercise. And I suppose endorphin makes you feel good. Is there anything mentioned in Buddhism scripture at all about exercising and calm your mind?
Well, in monastic life, we have daily tasks. We didn't actually do things like yoga or particularly formal exercises, but just the life itself would present us with enough exercise, ideally. But now I notice in Thailand, for example, when I first went to Thailand, the yoga was such a strange thing that, and I'd been practicing yoga before that, they didn't, you know, the monks didn't think that was a good thing to be doing because they didn't know it. But now the whole attitude towards yoga has changed everywhere, including here, including Thailand. So it's also like being aware of the body, because the body is the vehicle that we're living in for till it dies. And of course it is. It needs exercise. It needs, you know, paying attention to it is part of is mindfulness. Being aware of its limitation, of it, how to develop it in a way not through vanity or identity, but through respect for the physical form that we're living in at this time. So it all comes together, both the physical and the emotional and the intellectual, all these three kind of disparate conditions are then aligned through mindfulness, and so that they're supporting each other rather than conflicting.
Ajahn Sumedho, could you explain what people do during meditation when they're just sitting there? What do they do with their minds? And secondly, over time after doing that, time and time again, how does that make you a more peaceful, help you become a more peaceful person?
Well, there's so many different teachings and different techniques in the Buddhist world on meditation. But speaking from my own experience, let's say, that I started out through a very strong technique as I was practicing meditation in Bangkok. And that was a concentration practice. So I found, you know, that was the beginning. Before I'd never developed one point of concentration in the way that you do it, say, in samatha or concentration practices as developed in Theravada Buddhism. And that led to, you know, increasing faith and confidence in the practice. So there's what we call tranquility, moving towards simplicity, towards calm. Say the thinking mind tends to excite or worry, because thinking is a critical function, and it tends to make us wander. So we start with some kind of stimulation, and then the mind reacts to it with thought and carries on in its habitual way of proliferating thoughts and reactions to the feelings. But in concentration practices, we're usually focusing on something like a mantra or like the breath, breath of our own bodies, or focused on an object that moves us towards just concentrating on something that isn't exciting or interesting, but which is present, which is useful here and now, and which we can stop the limit the tendency to proliferate and worry and regret things of the past. So that this is one way of training. Then in what they call vipassana meditation is the what they call insight practices, and this is where we begin to investigate through observing ourselves. And so I found that I was a kind of obsessed thinker. You know, I was—I just had such an active mind, and it just rattled on and on and on. You know, day and night. The only kind of relief maybe was when I had a deep sleep. And when I first started meditation, it just—you know—just trying to I'd fight against it, resist it a lot. And then I'd feel very annoyed when things would happen that would break the kind of concentration that I developed. And so it was when I met Ajahn Chah, his was much more on the vipassana style of just observing. And I found that, for me, probably the suitable way of meditating, of just observing my frustration. I mean, when you're learning how to be a Buddhist monk and learning another language, in another culture, it's a totally frustrating experience. You know, you don't know what they're saying, or you know, they're different customs, different attitudes, and so one, you know, I felt a lot of frustration and anger arising through those, especially the first year. And Ajahn Chah was very good at getting me to look at that. You know, he'd get me to observe my suffering that I was creating. And I found that, even though, you know, most of what he said I couldn't understand verbally, I did get that point quite quickly. Observe the, you know, being the observer of my own anger or frustration. And I thought, and that just changed from, you know, tendencies toward trying to suppress the emotion, or deny it, or blame it on the conditions, you know, because being an American, you're culturally conditioned to be critical of everyone else's culture. So, you kind of easily say, they shouldn't do it like this, or this is not good enough, or why do they have to do it like that? And so in Lumpo Cha's way of pointing, when I began to observe this, how I, you know, the conceit I had from my own cultural background, and then the result of being caught up in just trying to control anger, or with celibate also, trying to control the sexual desires, and trying to create all kinds of situations that where I'd inevitably lose control. And then the point of Lungpo Cha's teaching was to be the observer of it. And I found that quite a shift in me, you know, that really found very suitable for the situation I was in, and also for my own character tendencies. And then over the through that kind of development, I began to see, you know, the causes of suffering and the end of suffering. I began to experience a peacefulness that came not through controlling the mind, but through letting go of the condition that I, you know, habitually held on to or resisted.
Other questions?
Yes, we were right on the borders of the war. Ubon province is the part of Thailand that is joined with Cambodia and Laos. And then there's a huge American Air Force base in Ubon at the time. And you hear the sound of the B-52s flying off to bomb Hanoi and whatnot. And of course, the huge American military presence was something that, Thai people couldn't figure out why an American would want to be a Buddhist monk. Because they saw the GIs zooming around on motorcycles and, you know, being, you know, like military men are. And they're quite impressed, actually, to see an American living in what they considered the toughest monastery in Thailand. And of course, they thought possibly I was, you know, I had a broken heart or my mother died. But this was also, you know, like having, you know, being, having lived through the Second World War and then in the Korean War and so forth, then it was during that time in 67 that the Vietnam War escalated, and America was very much involved in that, as you know. And it was, but I was not really affected by it as such. The what really affected me was not the war itself, but when the Americans left Vietnam. That was, I'll never forget, that's one of those memorable days of my life. When I was sitting in my hut, meditation hut, and somebody told me that the Americans had fled Vietnam, fled Saigon. And then we knew what was going to happen, because suddenly Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia all became communist. And of course, Thailand was supposed to, you know, they had this domino theory at the time that once those countries went communist, then Thailand and Malaysia, Philippines, Indonesia, all the rest of Southeast Asia would fall like row of dominoes. And so in Thailand at that time, there was incredible panic. And this was in about 1975. Ajahn Birdamo, he remembers that we were starting this particular monastery for training Western or non-Thai speaking people. And it's the first time that I began to contemplate going back to the West. Before that, I was perfectly happy living in Thailand, and I never thought of returning to the States. You know, that's why I was intending to, you know, if I went back, I'd go there. But then this fear, this sense of, what if Thailand falls? What will happen to all? And we had about 22 Western monks training at this monastery at the time. And then the next year, 1976, my mother was seriously ill, so I went back to see her in California. And then that led me to, I had to get back to Thailand, I had to go to London. And the Thai Airways had given me a free ticket from London to Bangkok. So I went to London for 3 or 4 days, and that was the connection. But also, you know, there was this, the Vietnam War, the end of it, in terms of the American involvement, was more traumatic to me personally than the war itself, which I had very little connection to. It didn't affect my life in the Buddhist monastery.
Are there other questions? I'll come over.
Ajahn, thank you very much for being with us today. So I'm thinking about the oil that is spilling into the Gulf of Mexico right now, and I'm wondering if you could say something about, from your perspective, the balance between letting go, so being in a place of inner peace, an equanimity about these conditions and at the same time not falling into a place of apathy, falling into a place of denial or ignorance about the reality of what is happening environmentally in the world.
Well, it's, now at this time, through the media, mass media, you hear everything. You know, so there is, so information is available from most remote parts of the planet to us all right here. And of course, it does sometimes, the way a Buddhist monk talks can sound like we just seek inner peace and that's all, that's all we're interested in is our own peaceful mind, and we don't care about what happens to you or the environment. But actually, we're interconnected, so even though that might even be a desire for some monks, it's not the way things actually are, that we're, through this, how I see it is the importance of this practice of meditation and realizing this, then this is also affecting, has its own effect on a wider level, because things like the environmental crises and the oil in leaking into the Gulf of Mexico, things like this are a result of, that particular thing is a result of greed, hatred, and delusion, our need for things, and also to uphold the standard of living, and that we, and this is because we're not content, we're not within ourselves at peace, so we do depend on having all kinds of other things to make us feel secure. Also, consciousness is one. We do feel very separate, like I'm sitting here and you're there, and we're two separate bodies. But in the Buddha's teaching, consciousness isn't a personal quality. And as we begin to align consciousness with wisdom, then this has a profound effect on consciousness, universal consciousness. And this is the gift of our human birth, is that even though we do seem very limited in the form, in what we can actually do as a human individual on this planet, when you look at yourself in just that very limited way as a physical form and a person, one can feel despair or hopelessness, because what can I do about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico personally? I don't have that much influence to, or ability to go and stop it, or to change anything other than trusting in the awareness of the moment, which to me is one way of doing what I know I can do, what is possible at every moment of my life. And then, of course, other occasions arise where one can act or accordingly, if one, that one isn't just indifferent or not caring, but through one's own influence or intelligence or personal talents or whatever, those things can operate through mindfulness rather than being the identities that we hold to and that tend to make us suffer even from our own intelligence or physical health or social position or political position that we're in. And also, you recognize that human, when you look at in my lifetime, the population explosion on this planet, If you see graphs of human population increase for planet Earth, it suddenly, after the Second World War, kind of shoots up from, you know, really fairly constant population level to, an increasing, like it suddenly it just zooms up into more than there's ever been on the planet to the present time. And then the modern systems of government are encouraging, independence, freedom, self-views, self-rights, and then encourage us to be consumers and to spend our money buying all kinds of things. So we're kind of manipulated into this unpleasant identity as a consumer. Actually, in the news, they don't talk about us as human beings, but as consumers. And so this, it means that, economically, that's what we are to the societies we're living in, is things to consume. And then when we don't, the economy crashes. Or, is there a better way? Is humanity, can we just change it and not be consumers just through, some kind of dictatorship or enforcement against consumerism? Or is there an ability that we have as human beings to develop beyond that level of self and identity and limitation through the conditioning to a universal? And this is what the Buddha is pointing to, is this universal in which our relationship is no longer based on just self-centeredness or identity with my particular tribe or group at the expense of the rest, but loving kindness, compassion, and joy and equanimity can operate through these human forms into the planet that we're living on. So even though we can be the worst destructive pests on this planet, as sometimes it looks like we are, destroying everything, but we also have this gift which has not been really developed very much of being vehicles for blessing, for goodness, for compassion, for joyfulness that can operate through human forms, through letting go of ignorance and understanding ultimate reality.
I think we have time for one more question. I'll just come down here because this is the closest. Sorry.
Thank you very much for having the opportunity to ask the last question. My question is, Theravada seems to me is the most austere and the most strict form of Buddhism. And as a Westerner, I'm going to Thailand to become a monk. You must have very high goal, achieving something. So after 40 years, do you feel that you achieve what you set out to have?
Well, when I went to Thailand, my only real interest at that time, I was about 30 years old then, and was in Buddhism for some reason, this particular teaching really appealed to me, and I just wanted to put it to the test, see if it actually worked, whether it's just another high-minded philosophy or another religion that promises all kinds of things but doesn't deliver. And so I wasn't blind to its difficulties or its flaws, because in any convention it has its own problems. But none of the problems I encountered were anything that really mattered that much to me, because the goal was very clear and the teaching was very simple. And so, and then over 40 years now, this will be my 44th year, is an incredible gratitude and trust in this way of life, actually, because it hasn't disappointed me in any way. In fact, it's better than what I expected.